tonight. We can start. I've got a couple of things there which you might find it entertaining to do a Google search for at some point. There are two things, both by Tim May, who was, as much as anybody, the central figure in the cypherpunks, and who's responsible for at least some of the ideas that show up in Chapter 3. He stole various ideas from me and got things out of them, and then I stole a bunch of ideas back from him, which is the way information sort of works in the academic world. He's not even academic. Tim was a Intel engineer who solved a problem for Intel. And if I remember correctly, Intel was having problems with its chips, and he realized that the reason for the problems was that chips had gotten small enough so that cosmic rays could affect them. And in any case, whatever he did, I think he was their chief engineer at the time, whatever he did for them was sufficiently generous, was sufficiently important, so they were sufficiently generous that he at that point retired for the rest of his life. Having what? 1990, maybe? Some fair while back. Yes. And anyway, and so he got interested in this whole encryption stuff and was involved with a variety of other smart and crazy people trying to figure out the implications of the technology. And Cyphronomicon is a sort of unfinished book of his, which explores a bunch of the ideas, and I think it's quite a lot of fun. And the Crypto Anarchist Manifesto, which is sort of a parody of the Communist Manifesto, is what he saw as the long-term political implications of encryption technology. And how much of it is right, I don't know, but it's quite neat stuff. Sort of almost like you're living in a science fiction story, you didn't know it, as it were. It's in a sense what he's saying. All right, I had a couple of things before we got going, and then I was hoping to find out what things you found puzzling or interesting about the stuff you've been reading. To begin with, as you may know, a number of the rooms in this building are set up for videotaping. I don't think this is one of them. But I was discussing with other people the general issue, and sort of my prejudice is that I would like to have all of my classes videotaped and available on the web for anybody who wants to read it for free. I figure that, speaking in economist language, the marginal cost of one more person watching this class is zero. Since you and I are doing the work of producing the class jointly, why not give it away for free to everybody else? And one of the issues that arises is whether students would feel constrained by the knowledge that they, as it were on television, not literally television, but being videoed and could end up on the web. So I was curious about your reaction. It's not doable at the moment, but if I had at the beginning of the course proposed that every class was going to be videotaped, audiotaped, and put up on the web for anyone to see, would people be bothered by that? Wouldn't feel embarrassed that somebody would see you saying, they'd only see the back of your head, of course, but they hear your voice. They'd see the front of my face since the camera would be in back. You wouldn't be bothered that a friend of yours would be, yep?
Is our name attached?
Is there what?
Is our name?
The answer is the web page wouldn't have it, but presumably somebody might recognize your voice, or, you know, somebody who was enterprising about it could deduce your name. My name would probably be there somewhere.
Reactions? No.
Sort of my idea of one way of making this university a more prominent university, it seems to me that the internet is a wonderful technology for giving away information and a somewhat clumsy one for selling information. And that the real trick to doing well on the internet, of which Google, I suppose, would be a star example, is figuring out how to make money by giving away information. So what does Google do? It gives away the very valuable information of what web page you want to look at. It's a search engine. And it makes money by selling advertising in connection with that, because when you've just put in a search string to Google, you have told Google what you're interested in, and that tells it what ads you might be interested in. All right, a very clever idea. And so I wondered if the Santa Clara University could somehow do a version of that. And the version that appeals to me is making it the sort of the place you go if you want to learn stuff relevant to law by simply giving away for free all information we generate that we're generating anyway. And so that would include videotaping classes and having them up on the web for free. It would include links to any student papers the students were willing to have links to. It would include link to any web books by the faculty that the faculty were willing to have links to, and so forth. And I was just sort of curious. I was discussing that with some other faculty members earlier today, and I just wanted to bounce the idea off people and see it. It wouldn't make you uncomfortable. It's a, no, good. Maybe I'll persuade people to do it next year or the year after.
Yeah.
What?
Are the professors also interested in doing
some are. Some are. Some aren't. A few people are worried, I think, about their privacy or maybe about students' privacy. You may be back getting sued for something, but my impression is that most are either neutral or have positive reactions to it. But I don't really know. I even had an idea for the webpage. I want this is a special webpage, not our regular webpage, to be called Silicon Rose. And you could have a glass rose, because glass, after all, is made out of silicon, as the sort of logo of it, with each petal being a part of the web page. But it's not going to happen. Just ideas that are fun to play with. All right. So next thing is, do you have any questions about the mechanics of the course? Do people feel at this point so they understand what they're supposed to do when? Stuff like that. Because if so, speak now or forever hold your peace. They say it enough. Yeah.
All right. It's
on the web page, and the way to find the web page. One more thing up here. Let me give you my URL. And about halfway down the page on my web page, there is a link to this course, and so you can follow that. And mine is very easy to remember. If you remember my name, and even I can usually remember my name, and I'm pretty bad at names. That's Friedman.com. So it's just www.daviddfriedman.com.
Gee, I can't find this. After Googling you, I found
yes.
this.
If you go to the middle, to about halfway down the first page, there are links to the classes I'm teaching. This is one of them. That'll take you to the web page for this course, and that has the detailed information.
So that page is for this year.
Now it is. It wasn't a few weeks ago, but now it is.
And I also have a question. Is this like a recording? Like
yes, I generally record the class video, audio record it. That's what this little gadget is. And put those up so that if you miss a class or if you want to review or if you are somebody not taking this course who lives in Shanghai or New Delhi or something and want to learn this stuff, you get to hear it too. My usual policy. If anybody has problems, let me know and I'll figure out how to edit your questions out. But absent that, I won't. But the basic framework is that you have three obligations for the course other than just showing up and talking. One of them is to offer legal issues raised by two of the technologies. So for two of the chapters, essentially, you're supposed to email me by Saturday midnight several, ideally, 3, 4, 5 legal issues that would occur if the technological revolution that chapter discusses happened. So if we have a world of strong privacy, which I'm not guaranteeing we will, we clearly have the technology, so it's possible that it may or may not happen. But if we have that world, what interesting legal issues would that raise? And I'm thinking of sort of a sentence to a few sentences, not an essay, but just, you know, how would we deal with such and such? And you're supposed to pick two of the chapters, two of the weeks, basically, for which you will submit issues. Email those issues by the Saturday after we discuss the technology and before we discuss the issues. And the idea is that Wednesday we discuss the technology, the next Monday we discuss the issues the technology raises, the next Wednesday is a new technology. Do that for two. You are supposed to do legal research on one of them in which you're looking at current laws that would bear on that. And you should take a look at the issue page for that one because at the bottom I've got links to old legal research, so try not to duplicate that. And then the main thing is you're writing a paper. The typical paper is going to consist of doing the same thing I do in the chapters. Take some technological revolution or some implication of technological revolutions that hasn't been covered and discuss it. All right. So to take one example from, I thought, quite a good paper a few years ago, a student pointed out that we are used to taking it for granted that everybody is unambiguously male or female. Due to increases mainly in biological knowledge, we now know that isn't true. We we know that some people are XXY genetically rather than XX or XY. There are a variety of other odd patterns. In addition, there are a small minority of people who at least believe that they are psychologically of one gender and physically of another. And so the paper was basically saying, given that male-female is not as sharp a line as we thought, how do different parts of our legal system handle it? So how do we handle it for sports? All right? What's defined as a male tennis player or a female tennis player? How do we handle it for prisons, where we're used to separating male and female, and so forth? Good paper. It was an interesting paper. It wasn't focusing on a big technological revolution. It was focusing on things that are already happening. But it was focusing on a non-obvious set of problems and implications of that one. A different one would be somebody who thought of some technological revolution that might happen. So that, for example, one that we discussed 2 years ago, and I left out this time because I didn't have room, is suppose we learn enough about how brains work so that we can raise the intelligence of some animals to a roughly human level. So suppose you could, by genetic engineering or mind drugs or something, produce chimpanzees as smart as people, or maybe even dogs as smart as people, or some other things. How would you fit them into the world? How would a legal system take account of that? So that one, we said, we discussed 2 years ago. I don't think we're going to do it this time. But if we hadn't discussed it, it would have been a neat thing for a student to have come up with as an interesting paper. So basically, you're supposed to find either some technological change that could have large effects that we haven't covered, or some set of effects we haven't thought about, maybe of some of the technological changes we have covered, and write a paper about it. So those are really the three obligations. And this brings me to the point that people ought to be thinking by now about which chapters they want to do issues for, because I don't want to have to do all the issues for the first few weeks. And basically, I've got a table which I'll be showing. I've got only one person on it so far, I think. Who has claimed which issues, basically. And I try to spread it out, so if too many people are doing, you know, if four people have already volunteered for this week, I'll probably tell you to do something else. But I don't remember. I haven't calculated how many it'll be this year, but it depends on how many people we have, obviously. Yes?
So, for the topics that we pick to suggest issues for,
yes,
can we also do legal research on
if
that
you like
as well?
Sure.
Okay.
Again, let me know, because I want to spread people out across the issues. But sure, if you're the first person who asks it, you can do it. If you're the fifth person, you may not be able
okay.
to.
Okay, why is one of the columns green? Or maybe that's just
because I could not figure out on the software I was using how to get it back to the background color. And I think that's a bug in the software, but I may have been stupid.
Okay.
good question. Yes, normally I use that. Once we've been going, I use the color to mark which ones are full. But that I basically took the table from 2 years ago, took off the names, changed the number of rows, put in a new set of names, attempted to change everything back to the background color, and for some bizarre reason, I could never get that color to go back. And I suppose if I were editing it in raw HTML, I could do it. But I'm using CMonkey, which is a free program in the Firefox family and the Mozilla family, and it's a free low-end HTML editor, and since I don't do fancy HTML things, it's just fine for me, but I couldn't figure out how to solve that. If anybody here who's an expert on HTML would like to tell me how to change that column to the background color, I would be grateful. I should say my family uses a sort of a familial system for computer education that I got myself a personal computer in the very early years of personal computer. And after a couple of years, my father wanted one, so I duplicated my system for him. Some years later, I wanted to set up a web page, so my adult son, who was, I think, at Harvey Mudd at the time, showed me how to set up a web page. So it's sort of a home production kind of system. Anyway, all right, so any more questions on the mechanics? Yes?
Can we just email you the ones you want?
Just email me. How about putting in the subject line legal issues? That's probably enough so that I can spot them. I could also make some unkind comments about the email program you're using at the moment, which is due to the fact that the email program I long used and loved doesn't run on the latest version of Apple's operating system, and I changed what was supposed to be an equivalent, which is very, very buggy, and I haven't managed to get out of that yet. So if you don't hear back from me, send it again. Because if you don't hear back from me, it may mean that it went into trash or junk or somehow I missed it. So think about which ones you're doing, especially if you'd like to comment on the fascinating issues we're starting the course with. Get it to me soon, and then we can do those. Next is any questions on the stuff we discussed last week, which was sort of general survey of how technology changes the world and what sort of technologies we're going to be looking at. No. All right, well, then let's go on to the real stuff, which is strong privacy. Are there any questions on how public key encryption works? I don't mean the mathematical details, but what is... I'm arguing that public key encryption is possibly the most important underappreciated technological breakthrough of the 20th century because it enables a whole bunch of interesting things. And are there questions about what it is, about what a public key and a private key are, how you use them, why they give you... Yes?
Is it something that can be embedded and not actively used? Like the software just run it by itself?
Yeah.
Essentially?
Okay. Yeah, sure.
So it doesn't require you to receive a coded message and then actually decode it?
If you were seriously using it, you would presumably have software such that when the message came in, the software would have a list of would have your private key if you're the recipient, and would just transparently read it for you. But this technology is used in lots of places. The internet stuff, there's a lot of stuff which is in fact encrypted in the background. You're just not seeing it. As you may have noticed, you occasionally get a message about security certificates, that this site's certificate doesn't work or something like that, how they put it. And what's going on there is basically digital signature technology is behind that, where somebody has verified, has authorized the site in some sense, and encryption technology is checking that somebody has really done it. Other questions on... All right, so everybody understands in a non-technical sense what public key encryption is, how it gets used, and how it solves the fundamental problem of how can I use encryption if I don't have a secure channel. All right, the fundamental problem is if I don't have a way of communicating with you such that I'm sure nobody else is reading the messages, how can I communicate with you while being sure nobody else is reading the messages? And single key encryption doesn't solve that, because I've got to get the key to you securely, and if someone else reads the key. But with public key encryption, I only have to get the key to you insecurely. I've got to have you know what my public key is, but I don't care if the rest of the world knows too. Much easier problem. So therefore, that lets you have a system where if everybody is using it, which certainly isn't the case, anybody can send a message to anybody with reasonable confidence that no one but the intended recipient can read it. That's the sort of the objective of the system. And there are a couple of potential weaknesses. One of them is key distribution, that I've got to make sure that what I send you as my public key is what you receive as my public key, that somebody, some bad guy doesn't somehow give you a bogus public key for me, at which point he can now read the stuff you encrypt with that, and I can't. And one method, in some sense the most elegant method, which is the one by the guy who created PGP, which is the best known free encryption software, is what he calls a web of trust. And the basic idea is that anytime I communicate with anybody, we exchange a list of all of the public keys of people that we have. And if you've been doing this for a while, you now have 17 assertions of what my public key is from 17 of the last 100 people you talk to. If they all agree, you're fine. If they don't all agree, you know there's a problem, that somebody has spoofed my public key somehow. So that's a decentralized form of key distribution, whereas what I initially described in the chapter is a more centralized system where some trusted organization provides the signed statement, David Friedman's public key is such and such. All right. So that's one problem, is key distribution. The other problem is human error, essentially. And that is people who you handle it themselves and they write it on a piece of paper and it's sitting on their desk and someone comes in and reads it. I don't remember if it was encryption or a password, but I remember one of the stories is what's referred to in the relevant community as human engineering, which means tricking people, not computers. So you're a not very high-level secretary at some big firm, and you get a phone call, and the phone call says, this is Vice President Mumble Mumble. I've got to access our database right now for a really important transaction, and I don't have a password. What is it? And very likely, the secretary is not sufficiently, you know, courageous and firm-minded to realize I don't actually know who that person is, and gives out the password. So versions of that for all kinds of encryption you have to worry about is you have to worry about somebody who actually gets physical possession of your computer for a while and you get information off that. So you have to think about, and one of the standard solutions to that is the information on the computer is only accessible with a passphrase or password that you've got memorized. Yeah?
How is protecting your private key any different than protecting, say, the passwords that we use now?
It's the same issue. But passwords are mostly not very secure, right? Unless you're doing something really important, your password is designed to keep a random person from impersonating you. It's not designed to keep the National Security Agency from accessing your stuff.
So I'm trying to see how protection with private key is higher than that with the password.
It's rather that it does something different. That the private, if as long as I have my private key, I and only I can read messages sent to me encrypted with my public key. So furthermore, as long as I have my private key, I and only I can digitally sign documents and thus prove I'm me. So if you imagine for a moment a world where there's a lot of online commerce, and not uncommonly people are dealing with other people they've never met, which happens today, of course, you want to sign a contract. You want not only to prove to me that you're the person who signed the contract, you want to do it in a way so that I can prove to other people, so that I can make sure you fulfill the contract by threatening to show other people that you promised X and didn't do it. That's reputational enforcement. If somebody else has your private key, that someone else can impersonate you. In a very general sense.
Yeah.
Can sign that contract with you not even knowing about it. So it's not, the issue of keeping it secret is the same issue as any piece of information that you're using, such as a password. It's just that a private key is, as it were, a very powerful password equivalent, because that one piece of information makes it possible for other people to securely communicate with you and makes it possible for you to prove your identity online to anybody, assuming your public key is mindable somewhere. So a password is for a particular site. It's how they've got it set up. And, of course, a password can be set up in such a way that, in a certain sense, nobody has it. The sort of standard procedure for computer passwords. Suppose that we've got computer passwords for accessing a computer, and we're worried that somebody might manage somehow to get unauthorized access and read off the list of passwords from the computer. Because you might say, the computer has got to have those passwords in it so it can check when you send in a password. But it doesn't have to. Because what it can do is have a procedure, an encryption, single key, ordinary encryption. It has a procedure for encrypting the password when it comes in. And it has a list of what the encrypted passwords look like. All right? As long as you can't reverse that encryption. Suppose its encryption is half of a public key, private key system, but one of the keys was burned years ago, because we're never going to use them. What happens now is I send in my password, which is 27903. It encrypts it into something else. It then checks the computer file to see whether the encrypted version of my password is what its file says the encrypted version of my password is supposed to be. If it is, it puts me onto the computer. Make sense? But it never has the unencrypted version. Sending in the encrypted version won't get you onto the computer. All right. So that's an example of some of how they handle this in the real world for computer security. that ideally secret information, I think I have the quote there somewhere, safe to tell a secret to one, two, foolish, three, everybody knows it, which is from a 9th century Norse source. And the way I usually put it, basically, is that a secret is something known to one person. And that once the information is out, there aren't really reliable ways of controlling it, and therefore the best thing. All right. So, no more questions on how public key encryption works. How about digital signatures? Do people understand the logic of what a digital signature is and how that works? And if not, do you have questions? I'd like to ask about it. No. I'll speak fast. The key distribution problem. All right. Sort of what you're describing it for simplicity, you just put everybody's public key in the phone book. But then you can easily enough, you know, if you're a James Bond fan or equivalent, you easily enough imagine the bad guys who run off their own copy of the phone book, which is exactly like the real copy, except for one thing, namely the person they want to spy on, his public key is not really his public key. It's really a public key they have the private key for. They carefully sneak into somebody's house, replace his copy of the phone book with their doctored version of the phone book, and now he sends a message they can read. All right, people follow that? That's why centralized key distribution systems are vulnerable. And that's why you would like to have redundant key distribution systems. Key distribution systems where you have several different sources giving you the same information. I like to say redundancy is your friend. It's a good, useful rule in many contexts of life. That you know, belt and suspenders is the traditional version of redundancy. So you ideally want some way in which you get the fact of other people's public key from several sources. You can check that they all agree, and then you're pretty sure you know what the public key is. Right? Remailers. People understand what traffic analysis is. You're a cop, and you suspect that I'm engaged in a criminal enterprise. And for some reason, you either haven't gotten legal permission to tap my phone, or you don't have enough people working for you to listen to all those phone calls. What you do instead is you get the phone company to tell you the phone number of every phone that I call or receive a call from. That's traffic analysis. Or it could be email, or it could be physical mail. Any of those are the same idea. And what does that do? Well, you happen to know that there's good reason to believe that she is a hitman. And oddly enough, I sent a message to her just before him, who is, you suspect, one of my competitors, got killed. You now have some reason to suspect that I am really the criminal you think I am. Furthermore, you notice that I sent messages to him and him who you knew nothing about. So you promptly start investigating them because you suspect they must be part of my criminal enterprise as well. All right, make sense? So that's traffic. That's the idea of, instead of spying on people by reading what they say, you spy on people by seeing who they're talking to. And if you're good enough at it and you have enough information, it'd be very useful. If you don't want to be spied on, and the side of the encryption thing that I'm mostly thinking from, it's, you want to think from both sides. You want to sort of imagine yourself both as the cop and as the criminal, only maybe when you're imagining yourself as the criminal, you're not a criminal, you're a heroic freedom fighter trying to keep the oppressive government from doing something. You're somebody who doesn't want the government able to control you, and that's one way of looking at it. And the other way is you're the virtuous government agent trying to stop bad things from happening. You want to think of the problem from both sides. All right. So if I don't want people to follow that, I want to be able to communicate with some people in such a way that no observer, however much he's watching, can tell who I'm talking with. And I'm a bit paranoid, let us suppose, and I suspect that the National Security Agency has got every ISP in the world in their pocket. And they basically can monitor every message from anybody to anybody on the Internet. They can see what the message is and where it went. All right, that's the upper limit, as it were, of what you could imagine a really effective spying organization. So I say, in that world, how can I keep them from knowing who I'm talking to? And the answer is, I can. And the trick there, which is again a public key encryption trick, is the anonymous remailer. So the idea is that you're in the anonymous remailer business. What does that mean? It means that when I want to send him a message without people knowing I'm sending him a message, I send you a message. Your message tells you to forward the message to him. Now, if that's all it would do no good, because the spy would read the message to you and see it was being forwarded to. But you have a public key and a private key. I know your public key, just like everybody else knows it. All right? So the message to you, including his email address, is encrypted with your public key. So the spy can see the message, but he can't read it. When it gets to you, you strip off that layer of encryption using your private key. You now know the email address you're supposed to forward it to. If it's a secret message, the message itself has got a second layer of encryption with his public key, because I don't want you reading my mail either. All right? Make sense?
Are we mailers, they're just computers?
Well, basically, there's a human being somewhere running it, presumably, but the idea of a remailer is a computer which takes messages and sends messages. And in this fashion. Make sense? There was a famous case, a non-pendant file, a long time ago, which was using less security than I'm describing, and where eventually the Church of Scientology apparently fooled Interpol into thinking they had a legitimate complaint against somebody and forced a non-pendant file to give up information, at which point the proprietor closed it down. But that was not a fully anonymous remailer. That was a remailer which was functioning to, among other things, to allow critics of Scientology to post things without getting beat on by the Church of Scientology, which is a somewhat aggressive organization. So the only problem that I've described so far is that if you're working for the NSA, you got to strip off that top layer and you know who my message went to. So you can tell the NSA I sent it to him. But I didn't send it to him. Actually, I sent it to him, who's operating a second remailer. And it went from him to him, who's operating a third remailer. And from him to you, who's operating another remailer. So before the message got to him, it bounced through five remailers. In order to know that I sent a message to him, all five of them have to be working for you. All five have to be working for the same bad guy. The same national security agency, whatever it is. Make sense? Because if anyone isn't, then there's a broken link. Then there's a point at which you can see the message going in, you can see the message going out, but you can't tell whether it's the same message or not. Because there's a layer of encryption that's been removed, so the actual text of the message looks entirely different. Now, of course, for this to work, the remailer has to have a good deal of traffic. If you only got one message a day, then all they have to do is to see, who did you send it to today? But if you get 50 messages a minute, and if you randomly delay from 0 to 300 seconds when you forward it, they have no way of knowing which of several thousand messages that went in matches with the message going out. All right. So it really is sort of a magical technology. That's part of what I like about it, because it does mean that as long as you've got it set up right, even somebody with perfect spying facilities, as it were, as long as he doesn't know people's private keys, can't do graphic analysis on you. Alright? Make sense? People follow it.
Yep.
Alright. So I discuss in a later chapter anonymous e-cache, which is another part of the story. So let me just say for the moment that all anonymous e-cache means is a way in which I can make a payment to you by sending you a piece of information, such that you don't have to know who I am, I don't have to know who you are, and the bank that's ultimately holding the money doesn't have to know who either of us is. That's the logic of anonymous e-cash. And of course, that's what currency is now. It probably is better than currency because there are various ways in which they can try to track currency, but basically currency is a form of anonymous money. If I pay you a $5 bill, there's no need for me to know who you are, for you to know who I am, or for the bank, or for the Federal Reserve to issue the note to know who either of us is, which is why when people hire nannies who are illegal immigrants, they pay them in cash, right? Basically, instead of checks, because they don't. So the implications of this system are a potentially very, very private world. If you imagine a world where a large part of what's happening is happening online, we now have potentially a world where anybody in the world can talk to anybody else in the world on a private line, can get a communication to them, which even quite high-powered spy organizations can't read. That's part of what it gives. But the second thing it gives, which in a sense is less obvious but equally powerful, is identity at a distance through the signature, which among other things means you can have an online persona not linked to your real space persona. So that you can create an online identity, and that online identity can prove it's him. I can prove over and over again that I'm the same person online, but nobody has to know what continent I'm living on, whether I'm male or female, how old, what I look like, or whatever. And that's what I think of as the possibility of combining anonymity with brand name reputation. And that's where I got my Murder Incorporated story, which I think is a nice way of pointing out just how powerful this technology potentially is, because you could have a firm in the business of doing assassinations openly advertising that does assassinations, and yet still there are ways of communicating with it, but not ways of finding it. And that's sort of the guts of what you're getting out of this. And that's connected with what this whole Pippa SOPA controversy is over, because that has to do with people who own it. One of the things I can do with that, as I say there, is sell other people's intellectual property for a penny on the dollar. Or give it away in exchange for your watching my hands or anything else. Yeah.
So, an interesting thing you mentioned, about how something like the IRS will be able to track anything that has any kind of whether you work in the real world and you get like cyber, whatever,
right.
Or you work
right.
In the cyber world and get field cash, right?
Yeah.
But if everything's cyber, then you won't have any way of.
Correct.
But then I was thinking, like, in terms of. Like, what can you get in cyber world which will not be able to at all be.
You can get information.
Information. So, like, say you're playing World of Warcraft, right? And you write a paper for somebody online, that's how you get the credit, and then you use that credit for World of Warcraft. But at some point, you will be getting. For you to experience that, there will have to be some kind of.
I am playing World of Warcraft for the equivalent of anonymous remailer. That is, there's a term for it, because they actually exist for people who want to browse the web, private. What's the term?
Are they onion servers or something like that?
It might be, right? I don't remember. I haven't actually used them. It's not being used for World of Warcraft, but for web browsing, which is getting pretty close, there are things which are designed and atomizers. If you want to be, suppose you're a high-profile politician and you want to watch porn. And you are concerned that someone might discover this fact and reveal it at the critical point in your career, so you could do it. But that would equally be the case. You can think of lots of good and bad reasons for doing this, basically. And that's that one of the things about privacy is that it's sort of a morally neutral tool that you can use. One of the reasons, I discuss this more later, one of the reasons I want privacy is so that after defrauding you, I can defraud her without her knowing about it. That's the dark side, as it were, of privacy. But another reason is so other people can't do things to me. Yeah.
My problem was when, like, say, instead of World Bank, you're using something like Netflix, right? And then.
Right, even better.
You'll have you'll have an IP address for that thing in the stream.
But Netflix is going to let me download something.
Yeah.
I'm not going to get a physical tape from Netflix. I'm going to download the film from Netflix over the internet. And I'm going to download it through something like a remailer, through some method, so that you can't trace where I'm getting it. And now I've got it.
So remailing data would be not something just messaging us, has to actually handle huge amounts of data.
Yeah, that is. When I was originally writing this stuff, people were using modems, real modems, that worked with telephones. Someone somewhere in the world probably still has one, but most people now. I mean, I can connect through my cell phone. I can connect my laptop through my cell phone at a speed 40 times as high as I used to go through a modem, roughly speaking. And it's getting faster. So sure. No. In general, in order to have a world where large parts of what people are doing is done online, you need high bandwidth connections. But we're getting high bandwidth connections sort of faster and faster, and more of the world has got them.
High bandwidth.
Remailers there are different mechanisms. The remailer is a nice, simple one to describe. You need anonymizers, ways in which people can easily trace what's happening. That's right. may or may not happen. And maybe the people don't care enough about it, and maybe the governments can do a good enough job at discouraging things from getting into existence. You know, it's the sort of thing where you make one slip and somehow your identity comes out and now you're in real trouble. But these are at least potentials of technology, which is, in a sense, the point that's being made. Yo.
I was wondering about anonymity. The way you described that contracts happening with anonymous people, not linked to real space, is that happening? I mean, really, I mean, if you want to pay anything on the internet, I mean, either you say PayPal or a credit card, and all those are pretty much tied to your real estate, no matter what kind of street name you
use. We do not have an anonymous eCash yet. PayPal, the people who started PayPal, their original idea was essentially an anonymous eCash that could be used through pocket devices. And the guy who did it gave a talk here years and years ago on the subject. And they eventually apparently decided that wasn't a viable business model at the time, so they now have a system which is not anonymous. Now, my guess is that if you were reasonably clever, you could still find ways of doing credit card where you were never really giving away your real identity, where you have sign up for the credit card under a bogus. If you think about how many credit card offers you get in the mail, it's hard to believe that a reasonably clever person couldn't establish a credit card account without ever giving away his real identity. All right, if you do that, look, intercept some strangers, find the mailbox that's not being emptied, where the person has moved. Go through his mail every day until you come to a mailing that's offering a credit card. Send it back with his name on it. You now have a credit card account. Send in a change of address to a mail drop at a post office somewhere, which also doesn't have your real identity, so that you can pay the bills for that credit card. That would be one example. So at that point, you could do it. And I suspect that if I were a prominent politician who wanted to watch porn, I would probably figure out some way. Now, it might be simply just having a trusted subordinate who was willing to pay for my porn. But it might also mean, if I really didn't trust people, which if I was smart I probably wouldn't, finding some way of establishing a way of paying for stuff that did not really link to me. A lot of this really is, what are the potentials of technology? And probably some of them will happen and some of them won't. I didn't predict WikiLeaks. But I did have in that chapter, written well before WikiLeaks, trade secrets are us, we buy and sell. Which is sort of like WikiLeaks. It's the same kind of idea of how you get information that how someone who has a secret can get the secret to somewhere useful without revealing himself.
The U.S. government was able to start WikiLeaks by stopping the financial transaction.
Well, were they really able to stop it?
Well, I mean, then I think they went into financial trouble, right? Once those
maybe, but how hard is it going to be if somebody wants to do another WikiLeaks? You know, you can... It isn't very expensive to maintain a web page, right? Maybe a very fancy one with a lot of efforts might get complicated. And it's a big world, and there are a lot of different countries in that world. And, you know, I haven't followed sort of enough detail. I know WikiLeaks complained, and many people complained that they weren't allowing them to take credit card payments, basically. But they can still take, you know, money and mail to them in envelopes. And if you want to donate, you can donate cash too. So I think it's very hard, really, to stomp it. And that, as I say, WikiLeaks turns out to have a connection to all of this stuff. The reason I put up those two references there is Assange was a part of the Cypherpunks, which was the email network of which Tim May, who writes Cypheronomicon and the Cryptoanarchist Manifesto, was sort of one of the moving spirits of the Cypherpunks, and I knew him and was sort of very tangentially involved with that. And Cypheronomicon is sort of his unfinished book draft about the world encryption makes, and the other one is a sort of semi-tongue-in-cheek, semi-serious description of the political implications of it. So I think you can see in sort of the degree to which my chapter is a toned-down version of a lot of Tim's ideas, basically. And that's also why I sort of liked the line. I don't know how many of you followed the link to the WikiLeaks link on the syllabus, but the line from, where is it? Here we are. At last, at long last, the homemade nitroglycerin in the old cypherpunk's blast jack has gone off. And what's he saying? He's saying this bunch of crazy online geeks discussed ways in which the world could be radically changed and governments could be greatly weakened via encryption. That's the homemade nitroglycerin. My God, WikiLeaks just hit the headlines. And it's not doing it exactly the way they thought, but it did go off. And I thought that was... The article it's from is too long and sort of too pretentious, but it's a wonderful line. And I think I have a link to another one, which is an article about Assange, and that again is long, but it's sort of interesting to get some feel. And part of what impressed me about Assange was that he actually had an interesting idea of what he was doing. And what he is doing is not as simple as leaking things people ought to know. What he is doing is imposing a secrecy tax from his standpoint. What he is saying is, if you have an organization doing things that have to be kept secret, it's going to be harder. Not impossible. But you will know that if any one person you can't trust gets at those secrets the way somebody apparently did at these ones, they're going to be all over the world. So you've got to take all sorts of precautions. The more precautions you have to take, the more expensive and difficult it is to run an organization that has to keep things secret. And Assange's implicit assumption is, on the whole, organizations have to keep things secret or banned. Not necessarily inevitably. You could sort of plausibly argue that some kinds of scientific research you want to keep secret for legitimate reasons. But the basic idea is, if you don't want people to know what you're doing, there's probably a reason you don't want them to know what you're doing. And therefore, one of the interesting questions that sort of is going to be any, in a sense, ambitious person faces is, how do you change the world? Right? All of us want to change the world. We differ about, some of us want to change it this way and some that way and some that way, but everybody, at least that I know, is somewhat unhappy about what the world is like. And WikiLeaks struck me as quite an ingenious idea for how a small number of people can change the world by creating up institutions such that if any one person is willing to leak it, it's in the headlines, and therefore it is more difficult to do things you want to keep secret. And that struck me as a neat idea. And that sort of part of the story that interested me. So let me go back a step. In this world of strong privacy, what do you have? You have a world where, among other things, it is much harder for governments to enforce certain kinds of laws. That it is essentially impossible to prevent freedom of speech, because you can prevent real space freedom of speech. You can arrest guys with microphones or bullhorns or newspapers, but you can't arrest people with websites because you don't know who they are. I mean, that's the sort of the logic of this system. And there are really two different things happening, which are both connected, I think, with the WikiLeaks case, although the second one is more important. One of them is the anonymity, and the other is just that it's really cheap to make information. So if you think about it, they did know who Assange was, and they did find out the guy who leaked it to him because the guy was stupid and told somebody he had done it, basically. But WikiLeaks still got out, as it were. And if you just think, even without the encryption part, just the existence of the Internet means that the disseminating of news is much cheaper and therefore much open to more people. The example that struck me years ago was Drudge and the Monica Lewinsky case. I don't know how many of you followed it, but the Monica Lewinsky case was blown by Matt Drudge. Matt Drudge is a self-made online news source with, I think, substantial political biases of his own. And I think 10 years earlier, it is likely the case would never have broken. There would have been a small number of organizations that could have broken it, and all of them would have been reluctant to offend the president. They would have said this is out of bad taste to talk about, semen on somebody's dress, all the rest of it. There would have been probably some much smaller publications which would have been willing to break it and might possibly have come across it, though probably not, but which nobody was reading, essentially, which was sort of thought of as that group. Unless you were a member of whatever political faction that one represented, but we were thought of that way. But here, Drudge, without having to have lots of money and resources, but people send him stuff. In that sense, it's like WikiLeaks. And once he's demonstrated that he's got a good eye for newsworthy stuff, people start reading him, and now he blows it all by himself. So that's sort of one consequence of the internet, is in a sense to make publicizing things much easier. Now the flip side of it, of course, is that it also means you don't know whether what you really read is true. You never did know whether what you read is true, of course. But you know even less now, because presumably the New York Times, although certainly not a trustworthy organization, is more trustworthy than the random web pages. It's got a greater incentive not to tell lies that can get caught and so forth. So you're getting effects. I'm really going beyond the encryption part, but all of this is part of the same world of readily available networks that everybody can read.
Isn't that initially there was freedom of conversation on the internet, but now boiled down to what has happened on the television space, where a few channels or few properties kind of monopolize most of the traffic, and they become the channel for communication. That's very controllable by government. Google, they can ask them to provide them any information or choke whatever they.
But the internet doesn't really have that kind of economies of scale effects, right? Because on the internet, anybody can put up a web page, and as long as people have some way of finding it, you don't necessarily need Google, you only need word of mouth to find it once, and once you got it, you got it.
But the audience would be pretty small to have any significant effect on the.
Depends probably on how interesting the stuff is you're putting up, right? If you are putting up the Monica Lewinsky story, you can get a pretty big audience pretty fast. And once you do it, now the more serious news media are under real pressure because, you know, do they want to admit that they're in effect censoring the news by not publishing this obviously very interesting story. Now that's an interesting point, which I don't think I cover in the book. I'm just thinking that the other technological half of that story was DNA testing. The fact that it was possible to prove that Clinton was lying, not just to claim it was. And it would be interesting, because there's a sense in which DNA testing, and there must be some other cases, is a place in which technological change made it easier to establish truth. And it would be an interesting question to think about technological changes that do that and how they affect the world. That if you take the limiting case, suppose we had a really good lie detector. What would the world look like if we had a reliable way of telling when anybody was lying? And maybe we will, right? We've got better brain imaging stuff of that sort. That might happen. Anyway, that's a digression. I'm just sort of trying to think about technologies that can change the world, which is the subject. All right, so in the world that strong privacy gives you, you can't enforce certain bad laws, such as laws muzzling freedom of speech, but you also can't enforce some good laws, such as laws against kidnapping and murder. That is, you can still punish people for kidnapping and murder, but you can't catch kidnappers by monitoring the payoff. All right, in a sense, one of the real weaknesses with traditional schemes for either extortion or kidnapping is that at some point someone's got to give you a suitcase full of money and someone may be watching. And that's a hard problem. Well, that problem is solved. Once you've got anonymous e-cash, whole game is over. I kidnap your kid, or in a real world case before all of this, I am working for a company which has all of its critical information on computer tapes. I'm the guy in charge of the tapes, and I'd like to retire early. So I take the original tapes and all of the backups, and I go off with them. And I then send you a request I offer to sell them back to you. And he got caught collecting the money. That problem we've now solved. We'll solve once we've got a fully anonymous e-cash available, because he just asked you to transfer the money by anonymous e-cash. It's anonymous. So that's the downside of it, essentially, is that it restricts the ability of governments to do things in both things we don't want them to do and things we do want them to do. And of course, different people are going to disagree about what goes in which category. So that I once got a phone call from somebody who wanted me to speak at a conference on money laundering in the Pacific Rim. He identified himself as a forensic accountant, which I thought was a rather neat job description. And I said, "You do realize that I'm in favor of money laundering, don't you?" And he said, "Yes." So I went and I spoke. But the point is that from my standpoint, money laundering laws are mostly used to prevent victimless crimes, to prevent drug selling and gambling. I don't believe that either of those should be illegal. Therefore, from my standpoint, making it impossible to enforce money laundering laws is a plus. But I can understand perfectly reasonably that other people who think those things should be illegal or are concerned with other forms of money laundering transaction would say, no, that's a minus. So really, sort of the point from the standpoint of this chapter is not do you like it or don't you like it, but can you see what the implications of the technology are likely to be? And one of the points which people will differ on is whether we would like to make it harder for governments to collect taxes. And people who think, on the whole, the government spends far too much of our money will say, wonderful, let's make it harder for them to tax us. Other people will say, no, there are important things that government needs to provide. We've got a big deficit. We've got to cover it. We've got to make it easier to collect taxes. So again, you can pick your side, it's fine. All I'm saying is that one implication of this is that as more and more human activity moves online, it is going to become harder and harder for the IRS to monitor what people are doing and thus to tax them. And you could end up in a world where you still tax, but you only tax real space things. Where you have property taxes, property is nice real space, solid stuff. Where you have sales taxes on physical stuff, and you just give up on trying to tax the computer programmer who is selling his skills online and using the skills to buy data or computer games or other things online. So that those are possible things that that world could give you. And presumably, anybody who sort of has read this far and taken it seriously ought to be asking himself, could this be stopped? Ought to be thinking about, or regulated or controlled in some way. And way back when I started writing about this, this was quite a serious issue. There were various proposals having to do with phones, for example, where they wanted basically to have a encryption chip, a so-called Clipper chip, which the NSA was going to provide, which would be used to encrypt phone conversations, and which would be designed so that government authorities could decrypt what it was encrypting, and the hope, at least, was that people then wouldn't use any other form of encryption. And that one never went anywhere. But it was a big controversy back when I was originally teaching some of this stuff. There were restrictions on exporting encryption software, which is really sort of crazy because the mathematics had been public for a long time. You know, there are many things the Soviet Union was short of, but mathematicians was not one of them. So the idea that you could keep the Russians from encrypting by not letting Americans export encryption software was just insane. But maybe it wasn't the Russians. Maybe they were worried about the Sicilian mafia. Maybe Sicilian mafia doesn't have as good mathematicians as the Russians do. But still pretty hard. They can hire them, right? They hire people. So that was, at this point, as far as I can tell, that kind of attempt, I think, has largely died down, and now it's really the things that are being pushed are attempts, I think ultimately none of them are likely to succeed, to prevent the consequences, to do things such as saying, if we detect that your web page is selling someone else's intellectual property or giving away someone else's intellectual property, we can shut it down. And to some degree that's doable, but Wikipedia just shut itself down for a day in protest over the implications of what you had to do in order to do that. Because how do you find out whether it's true? How do you find out whether I really am hosting someone else's intellectual property or just linked to some other site that does it? How would I know? And how do you even know whether it's protecting intellectual property? And you can think of an awful lot of complications. And I think the feeling of a lot of people was, well, it's too bad if a certain amount of piracy occurs, but it's worse if you make it harder for the Internet to function, because the Internet's become very important to us. And that was more or less the conviction that I was offering in the book. It may or may not in the long run be true, but I think it would be. But then the other point that I try to make in the book, which I think is an interesting one, in for all the technologies practically, is there a way in which the technology can solve its own problems? There's sort of this mythical belief that if poison ivy is a problem, there must be some plant growing close to poison ivy that cures it. And there's no reason why this, there's no theoretical reason why this should be true, but it sort of fits human beings' idea of suitability, as it were, that the cure should grow close to the disease. Well, sometimes it's true, and if you're lucky. And so one of the questions to ask is, if encryption technology creates these problems, can it solve some of these problems? The answer is some of them it can. The simple example is that you can't assassinate someone if you don't know who he is. So therefore, if I'm going to do something which might get some unscrupulous organization really mad at me, for example, be rude to the Church of Scientology, which I think is surely morally capable of engaging in assassination, though I don't know if they ever have, but they've got quite a history of moderately ruthless behavior against their opponents. If I'm going to do that, do it through an anonymous remailer, use encryption, do whatever I can so they don't know who I am. And that's it's not a complete solution. As I say in the book, it's sort of hard to conduct a marriage via encryption online, and it might be your wife who wants to have you killed, but it means that at least some noticeable number of the things that could be protected that way. If you want to publish a book which is going to very much anger Iran or North Korea or the President of the United States or anybody else who, you know, is in a position to have people killed, you might want to do it not under your own name. So that's a partial solution. And with regard to copyright kinds of issues, some of those problems, but not all, can be dealt with by encryption. This is a point I think I discussed before, that if you have intellectual property fully revealed on one use, then however good your encryption is, there isn't a really adequate way of protecting it, because the first time someone uses it, he has a tape recorder listening to the song, or he has a camera photographing his screen, which he then re-digitizes to get your novel back. All right, so therefore, but many important kinds of intellectual property are not fully revealed on one use. World of Warcraft is not fully revealed on one use. Lexis and Westlaw are not. So if you're selling the kind of intellectual property where you can sell it in the form of access to our database, not a copy of our database, then if you use encryption sufficiently intelligently, you can keep other people from getting at it. All right, so that's the case where some of the problems can be solved. And then there are a variety, that the other solution, which isn't time technology, is to say, all right, if I can't enforce copyright, how do I get paid for what I do? Well, you can have a patron. You can get paid because your book or song is dedicated to some company that wants good PR. You can get paid if you've got really enthusiastic readers by saying to those people, I will only finish this book when I get 100 people who agree to pay me $10 each. There were, in fact, in the 18th century, books that were sold in that kind of model in which you said, we're taking subscriptions, and when a certain number of subscriptions arrive, we'll print up the book. And a few people made money that way. I mean, it was not an impossible. And you can think of a lot of other models, of models in which, I mean, think for a moment about almost all academic publication. If I write a journal article and publish it in an academic journal, do you know what the journal pays me? If I'm lucky, nothing. If I'm lucky. With a physics journal, I gotta pay them. It depends on the field. But the answer is basically nothing. That's right. What, however, do I get paid? Not by the journal. What do I, in fact, get paid by publishing an article in a top law review? Correct. Thousands and thousands of dollars, right? I'm worth much more to my employer, the law school. Maybe I get an offer from a better law school, right? So that's a case in which you have a very large-scale production of intellectual property, essentially the whole non-book academic market, and probably 95% of the book, lead-on textbooks. If you think about treatises, it's the very, very rare academic treatise by a professor that makes him any significant amount of money. But what does it make him? It gets his name up there. It means people say, you know, I've heard of him when I read his book, or at least someone told me he wrote the classic book on subject X. All right. So that's a whole model It's rather like the open source model for software, if you think about it. And it's been going for a long time. It used to work tolerably well. One of the reasons that I web my books whenever my publisher will let me do it is that I'm not writing the books mainly as a source of royalties. I'm writing the books mainly because I have ideas I want to get out there, and this is the easy way to do it. And secondarily, because I'll get speaking engagements and being more valuable to my employer and stuff like that if I have high visibility to people who are reading my books and reviewing my books. So from that standpoint, there are models. All I'm saying is that the solution to copyright violation doesn't have to be enforcing copyright law. That's one possible solution, but if it gets harder and harder to do that, the more sensible solutions is find other ways of rewarding people for producing intellectual property, and there are a bunch of other ways of doing it. That's sort of the bottom line in the death of copyright story, at least in my view. Let me quote you a little bit from the Crypto-Anarchist Manifesto, which I happen to notice as a reminder to be of WikiLeaks. The state will, of course, try to slow or halt the spread of this technology, citing national security concerns, use of the technology by drug dealers and tax evaders, and fears of societal disintegration. Many of these concerns will be valid. Crypto-anarchy will allow national secrets to be traded freely and will allow illicit and stolen materials to be traded. Him made the manifesto. Well, the secrets weren't just traded, they were published to the world and embarrassed a bunch of people. Let me go for a moment a little bit to the question of the privacy issue in general. And the question I want you to think about is, do you want people to know things about you? That there's a tendency for people to sort of say, well, privacy is a good thing. It can't be an unambiguously good thing, or there wouldn't be people in Hollywood who are in the business of trying to get their customers into the newspaper. Right? So it's clear that privacy, at least in that sense, is a mixed item. And from my standpoint, it's a mixed item for sort of a lower profile reason, that if only everyone in the world knew I didn't have a mortgage, I wouldn't get interrupted at dinner by people trying to refinance my mortgage. On the other hand, if everybody in the world knew that I was interested in very early varieties of fruit trees and wanted to plant more of them, maybe instead of getting the spam I get, I would get spam from somebody telling me, did you know that the white pearmain apple has been traced back to 1200 AD and we sell seedlings of it? I planted it two weeks ago, actually, that particular variety is why I'm quoting that one. But I didn't find it that way. I found it with Google. So in that sense, there's much to be said for people knowing. And you can think about it in a whole lot of other contexts. Imagine, you know, that your marriage is just broken up. Well, it's sort of embarrassing people to know it. On the other hand, there are certainly we would like to know you're back on the market, so to speak. And more generally, if you think about, you know, one of the really major human preoccupations is finding mates. Well, in a way, privacy hurts that. You would like, you know, in a sense, however odd you are, somewhere in the world there's somebody for whom you're the right match. How do they find you? Well, if there's lots of information about you readily available, then they can do it. Sort of the problem, presumably, with most computer dating stuff is that both sides have an incentive to lie about themselves because you want it just as in all advertising, you've got that problem. But insofar as you have poor privacy, people can find out what your income is. And if somebody says, I want to marry a millionaire, well, I'm not sure I want to be married to someone who wants to marry a millionaire, but some people, there's only millionaires who would say, great, you know, as long as she meets my other requirements, fine. But you don't want to marry someone who only pretends to be a millionaire. So that's the kind of case where privacy is a cause. And then part of the question is, what's the other half of it? Why is it that people have as much of an instinct as they do that they want to keep their secrets secret? And part of it is a bad reason. Part of it is the reason I want to keep the history of my first marriage secret is because I really behaved pretty badly, and therefore a sensible woman will be reluctant to marry me. That would be a possible reason for wanting privacy. And you can expand that in a whole bunch of different ways, of contexts in which people want I should say this is a purely hypothetical case. Actually, I behaved perfectly well in my first marriage. It was all everybody else's fault. But that's another story. There are clearly good reasons why you don't want privacy. There are clearly bad reasons why you want privacy. But there may also be good reasons why you want privacy. And you are welcome to submit to suggest some. Why do you want people not to know your secrets for a reason that you could explain to other people in justice? Not because your secrets are that you're a bad person who's done the legal will for it. Am I right in assuming that everybody here has a gut level feeling that they would like some privacy? Right? Why? We don't ask that question often enough about many different things.
It's embarrassing. Everybody knows your secrets.
So one answer is that there may be cases where the mere fact of having the knowledge out is embarrassing. Yeah, my hypothesis for that is, suppose you had testicular cancer, and as a result you're now a eunuch. Most men would prefer that people not know that. Now, as it happens, I know somebody whom it's true online. I've never met him in real space. And he doesn't keep a secret at all. I mean, he's perfectly willing to discuss the subject. But you can certainly imagine things like that. But there's sort of a fine line between I don't want it because it's embarrassing, and I don't want it because it reflects badly on me. And it's not clear. It's clear why you don't want people to know things that reflect badly on you, but it's not clear why other people should respect that desire, because they like to know if you're a real relative, so to speak. Other reasons? Yeah?
Is this worry that if there is disclosure, you worry about its accuracy? So then, if there's less privacy, at least for me, I feel like I'd spend my entire day browsing, Googling myself, and going around correcting things.
You mean you don't? You mean you don't?
Well, I mean,
Wikipedia used to have my birthday wrong.
Yeah, I mean, personally, yeah, I've had to go back to, to in college, and the school newspaper, please, edit that for me, because I'm applying a job, and it's the first thing people see.
Yes.
So, if I was slightly more popular and wanted to have my presence online, then I'd need more information that I got to scan on a daily basis and go out and correct, and pretty soon I do nothing but do that all day.
So you should notice sort of the other side of that is it is an awful lot easier than it would have been 20 years ago, because you can use Google. I mean, I can literally search the world to see if people are saying false things about me. And I occasionally do as it happens. That's not for very important reasons. But that's sort of a neat technology. But yeah, so if you had a world where everybody knew you couldn't find out things about people, you wouldn't have that worry. On the other hand, if you had a world with very little privacy and then you could easily find out true things about people, you also wouldn't have a problem. It's sort of the intermediate case where that occurs. Other people have. Can you? Yeah.
People have different norms about what is or isn't objectionable, and to have a society where we have all these different norms, and people have to interact with each other, having things that it's preferable to have a lot of these things private, so that you can have these interactions without one person thinking it's objectionable while another does not. You don't know. Does or doesn't find it.
It's tricky, because the flip side is that, in a different way of putting it, is that you are asking to have a world where you can deal with me only if I really knew the truth about you, I would sort of regard you as a filthy person I didn't want to deal with, and that sort of seems a little unfair to the other side. I mean, it does certainly lower some costs. Let me take a much simpler case. Let us suppose that you have a total assets of $15 million, and you don't want to live a showy life, and you didn't obtain it in a way that's obvious to the world, and you have small children. All right, you've just become a target for a kidnapper. So that would be one reason why you would like to conceal information about yourself, because information about yourself could be used forcibly, essentially, against you. All right, and that's a pretty serious reason. Let me take a different one, which is actually neither good nor bad, but which struck me because of a real-world example. And that is, the house we have in San Jose is a little over 100 years old, which is quite unusual around here, and it has a substantially bigger yard than this house. And we got it at what was a reasonable price at the time we were on the market, about 15 years ago. There was probably a range of $50,000 or $100,000, say at least $50,000, between what we ended up paying and what we would have paid if we had to. Because we really like old houses, and there aren't very many old houses around here. If the sellers had better information, if the sellers had been able to listen to our private conversations, we would have had to pay more for that house. So, now, in one sense, as an economist, I say, but it would be better if they had that information. Because the danger, if they don't, is bargaining breakdown. You may have they may think the house is worth $600,000. It's really worth $550,000, and so we don't get the house, even though $550,000 is more than they sell to anybody else. So that's the argument against privacy. But you can certainly see that one reason to want privacy is that there are bargaining situations in which if other people have information about you, you will get worse terms of the market. So that's another reason. Anyway, we're running out of time, but think about it, because it's sort of, everybody tends to take it for granted that privacy is a good thing. And if you're interested enough, I've got a number of essays on privacy, one of which is the defense of privacy. But think about it, and you know, let me know next time. And I hope that a couple of you will think this stuff is interesting enough so you'll want to send me issues on it. And if so, email me first to make sure that you're not the ninth person who's doing it.